Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
For me, there's no tick box. Mm. Like, you're 40, you've got to wear a Laura Mercier camouflage concealer, you've got to wear a Bobbi Brown lipstick, you've got to wear a Daniel Sandler blusher, blah, blah, blah. Every woman is different.
Hello and welcome back. Today's guest is the makeup artist and brand owner, Daniel Sandler. I first met Daniel about six, seven years ago. He was doing an event that I brought my mum along to, and he gave her some makeup advice and was so kind and so sincere and just wanted to help us find the right products. And that meeting really stuck with me. And every time I've seen Daniel since, I've noticed how generous he is with his time and knowledge. And he has plenty of knowledge because he's had a stellar career in makeup. We talk in this episode about how he found success and about his life, as well as, of course, some of his makeup philosophies and how he came up with his famous watercolour blush product, which is a makeup artist staple. I've seen it in countless kits on shoots and backstage. So if you want to infuse your face with life, get your hands on a bottle. It is brilliant. Here's Daniel. So tell me about young you.
Young me was brought up just off the King's Road near Sloane Square. Obviously an amazing location, but very quiet, a very quiet area, apart from when people flood in to come up and down the King's Road.
Yeah.
You don't really have friends next door. I wasn't a kid who kind of had friends who lived in the building and all this sort of thing where we lived. So it was quite a solitary...
Were you an only child?
No, I've got a brother and sister. My brother and sister are both much older, 9 and 11 years older than me.
Right.
So when I was sort of a teenager, my brother was in the army. Before that, he was in the boarding school. My sister was at school in London, so I grew up more with my sister. And my parents went away. Both parents were working, but they'd go away at weekends and for holidays.
Your dad was a hairdresser?
Yeah.
And what did your mum do?
My mum was an interior designer. And then she became an importer of chocolates, sugared almonds, and beautiful chocolate dragées.
Oh, okay.
And she was the first person to actually sell wedding favours. You know the Italian bomboniere?
Yeah.
She was the first person to do those really beautifully for Harrods and for Fortnum's and for Jackson's of Piccadilly. So apart from school, which I hated, I absolutely hated school.
Were you good at anything at school?
French, English, and art.
Okay, fine.
Really good. Mm-hmm. I was crap at sciences, and I was brilliant at music.
Okay.
And I went to the Royal College of Music and I did violin and piano as well.
No, you didn't, did
you? Yeah, I did. Yeah, Saturdays.
Did you?
Yeah, and I did my grades and things.
Yeah.
And I started violin at school when I was 4.
Did you ever think about becoming a violinist or a pianist?
No, because I absolutely love makeup.
So when did the realisation that makeup existed, when did that come to you?
I think I was... It was through my spotty phase. And the great thing about having a spotty phase and being into fashion is that at the time in the 80s, boys were putting makeup on themselves and it was a real fashion thing. Punks had gone, new wave was sort of there, but the kind of fashion music vibe that I absolutely loved was the new romantic.
Right.
So I wanted to do everything and I look like Steve Strange or David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go and I would buy very... simple makeup. Firstly, really to cover up my spots, because...
Which products? Do you remember where you were going and what you were buying?
Absolutely. Boots number 7. I bought whatever I could. There was a Rimmel cover stick, and I think they probably still make that. It looks like a lipstick.
Yes.
They still make that. That was amazing. Mary Quant makeup I'd buy, because my sister was working in Harrods in the weigh-in department on the 4th floor.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really cool.
I love weigh-in.
It was so trendy.
Yeah.
So there'd be Miner's makeup, Stage Light makeup, and Mary Quant had a fantastic concession.
Right.
And all these brands had beautiful, bright colours and things. And then, of course, it was all about fake tanning after that.
Were you instantly good at putting makeup on?
I don't think I was. I think I probably enjoyed it more, and I loved the effect that it gave.
Right.
And I remember at school, at secondary school, I was at school with Hugh Grant.
Ah.
And I had to do his makeup because he was on stage.
Okay.
I was either shoved in the orchestra or I was told to do makeup. Orchestra, because of the violin.
Yeah.
But this time I said, no, I want to do the makeup. And, you know, so.
Right. So you're making up celebs even before you knew you were making up celebs, before they were celebs.
Isn't that wild? Yeah. So, oh my, and he was really cute. Anyway.
Yeah, he's a good looking man. Yeah.
He is.
Yeah.
But what I learned from one of the teachers was that if you grind down old fashioned chalk that we used to write on the blackboard, you can get pigment. So, of course, there was green pigment, purple pigment, bright pink pigments, white pigment. Mm. So I used those with talcum powder, and I used to kind of make up colours and put things on people to make them look different and ready for stage.
Now, although at that point it was quite natural to wear makeup, and as you said, culturally people were wearing makeup, was there any point at which you struggled with the fact that you were a man and you liked makeup?
Oh, I absolutely. Also because it wouldn't have been something that my parents would have wanted to see me wearing.
Right. So did you hide that from them?
Yeah, absolutely. And because they used to go away every weekend
to
the country, I would go completely wild. And I'd have my friends over and we'd all get dressed up ours. And because my dad had a hair salon, I had all the hair products.
Yeah.
Had the hairsprays, the gels, everything, the hair crimpers.
Yeah.
And I'd get me and my friends ready and we would parade up and down the King's Road. I was photographed for the Sunday Times, put in a feature, and my parents used to get those papers. And I told my dad one time when the paper turned up on the mat on a Sunday morning, I said, they didn't put the supplement in this week, Dad.
Did you?
Because I knew I was in it, leaning up against the wall with a guy who looked exactly like David Sylvian from Japan.
Right.
And we were both doing really campy poses.
Would he have recognised?
No. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely not. And then, of course, I would have thought, well, maybe some of my family are going to see that.
Had you come out at this point?
No.
Okay, so
not at all. Your,
that whole other identity was hidden.
Yeah, I didn't come out till my 20s.
Okay.
Late 20s, actually.
Do you think that was that created a tension in your life, or were you quite good at separating the two parts?
No, because I didn't really. I don't think I wanted to be gay because I knew I was attracted to men.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was attracted to women as well. So I had girlfriends.
Right.
Which kind of kept my parents kind of happy and things. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I wanted to be gay because I didn't want my parents to dislike me or be embarrassed. And then, of course, that affects the family and how the family react with you and all this kind of thing. So, of course, you kind of feel sort of on your own as if there's no one to talk to. It was difficult, but I really loved the idea of changing my look completely.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first time I've said to people that I was a really ginger, spotty kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't really get fancied when you were ginger and spotty. You either had to look like Tom Cruise, dark and masculine, or you had to look blonde and sexy, you know, that kind of thing. And I didn't fit into that stereotypical.
So, when you're young, it's very there's very much moulds of what's attractive, aren't there, in a time. So
still
it's like,
is.
Yeah, still now.
Always. There's always that stereotype that you have to look like that and have the right things and have the right trainers or whatever.
Yeah.
But so I found that I could express myself being a new romantic with the mate. And I just absolutely loved
it. Did you do the clothes? You did all the clothes
too? Everything.
Yeah.
What was funny was my mum really enjoyed making outfits for me.
Did she?
But she never really saw me in them.
Okay.
But she'd make me these, because mum came from India and she's British, but born and raised in India, came and lived here. The first thing she did, dressmaking at St. Martin's with some really cool other young designers and things. So she learned how to make outfits and things. And she always had a sewing machine on the dining table.
Mm-hmm.
So she'd either take my trousers in and make them into drain pipes or whatever for school.
Yeah.
Or I'd give her some fabric that I found. I'd say, Mum, just make me a pair of kaftan trousers or something. She would absolutely love it. But if they saw me wearing makeup and going out really, you know, like a peacock and looking absolutely wild and beautiful, as I would like to think, my father would have been absolutely livid, seriously angry, and I would have been, he would have taken all my clothes away and all this kind of thing. After I left school, I went to the London College of Fashion, where Dad wanted me to do a hair course, follow in his footsteps and eventually take over his successful businesses.
Where was his business?
He had one in Knightsbridge, and he had two in South Kensington.
What were they called?
The one in Knightsbridge was called Miss Knightsbridge, and it used to be above the Fiorucci store, which opposite Scotch Corner, which was where Scotch House used to be, and two on the Old Brompton Road.
Okay.
Actually, one was down Bute Street, if you know South Kent, opposite the French Lycée. There's a little cool little street.
Yeah.
And then the other one was around the corner on the old Brompton Road near Queen's Gate.
Yes.
So what happened was that I didn't particularly want to do hair only, mm-hmm. even though a lot of my time was spent Saturdays and holidays in his hair salon, sweeping floors, taking coats from clients, mm-hmm. taking the money, you know, washing hair, all this kind of thing. So I grew up with that as a child. It would have been natural for me to go into the hairdressing business.
Did you have an aptitude for it?
Yeah, I could do it.
You could do it, okay.
I didn't like doing it.
Yeah.
But I could do it. And of course, my dad was very much a hairdresser from the 50s and mm-hmm. 60s mm-hmm. and the 70s. So his training was wonderful old shampoo and sets, classic,
yeah.
you know, pin curling, finger waving, all that. To watch him work was just incredible.
I can imagine.
And some of his clients were some of London's elite. It was royals, mm-hmm. it was actresses, mm-hmm. society ladies. And I'd go and watch him work for Harper's Bazaar magazine.
Wow. So you're constantly absorbing all these visual references, even
yeah.
through your parents, which not many people have that. I mean, even if you have an aptitude for beauty and you're seeing it everywhere, but the fact that it's in your house, your mum's sewing, you know, your dad's
yes.
cutting hair, it's a very hands-on
yes.
Education in how to behave around people and also, you know, giving you these influences.
And I think you don't realise, but you're like a sponge
yeah.
and you absorb it.
Mm.
And I would see these ladies come into my dad's hair salon, little old ladies with grey hair, Duchess of whatever, and he'd make them feel absolutely fantastic. And I would see the way that he would talk to them, and I would see the transformation of these ladies who would come in religiously on a Friday or a Saturday once a week to have a shampoo and set, a chit chat with Mr. David, you know, a cup of tea and a biscuit, and they'd go out feeling wonderful. So I grew up with that, but my father knew I wanted to do makeup as well, so he said, okay, well, if you want to go to the London College of Fashion and not just do hair only, they do a makeup course, so it's makeup and hair. So I did one of those courses, absolutely loved it, because I came from an all-boys school. Suddenly I was with girls, and it was fun, and being quite an extrovert camp boy at that age who loved wearing makeup, girls... You're
loved
like a
you.
Magnet. And at the London College of Fashion, there weren't really that many boys.
Mm-hmm.
So I suddenly was in my element and I loved going to college. And then from college, at college, there was a makeup artist called Kim Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kim is somebody whose work I knew in the 80s and 90s when she first started. She came to college, but she was already out there working. And she said to me, Daniel, come and watch me work.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, that would be absolutely lovely. So I went to a studio for the first time to see a makeup artist work properly. And I loved what she did. And I knew then that I wanted to concentrate on makeup. So I started building a portfolio. I started meeting photographers. Being fortunately located very central in London, you go to parties, you meet models, you meet photographers, hairdressers, stylists. And my father, as I said, he used to do a lot of shoots and he worked a lot with Terence Donovan.
Right.
Which leads me to one of the very first jobs where I assisted an amazing makeup artist on one of the Robert Palmer videos.
No.
The artist who actually designed the black eyes and the red lips
that.
Was an amazing South African fella
yeah.
called Martin Pretorius.
Mm-hmm.
And Terence Donovan booked me for a lot of jobs, but subsequently, I worked with him on many, many editorials and things.
Mm-hmm.
But for this particular job with him was the first time I ever assisted anyone. And I had to create some of those faces on some of the other Robert Palmer
Amazing.
Videos, which was similar to the original...
Addicted to Love.
Addicted to Love. So it was very monumental and very iconic time.
Also part of the scene. I mean, it sounds like you were really part of what was going on and the culture of makeup and stuff like that. So incredible.
Well, there weren't that many of us around. Another job that I did, and it was the first time I worked with Yasmin Le Bon. I turned up at Jubilee Halls in Covent Garden because it was the St. Martin's fashion show. It was their degree show.
Yeah.
And there were very many famous who became really, really famous fashion designers subsequently.
Mm.
And it was incredible to be... I was assisting a girl called Lynn Easton,
mm-hmm.
who was with a very creative agency called Creative Workforce, and they did a lot of the funky pop singers like Steve Strange and you know, whoever. So to assist Lynn was amazing because she used to do Boy George as well, and she had dreads and she just looked the part.
She did a lot of music stuff, didn't she?
She did. Do you know the name?
Yeah.
Lynn Easton.
Yeah.
I was just drinking in all this coolness.
I
was nothing. I used to go to the Candle Palace and I used to see Boy George and Marilyn and Steve Strange running around and it was absolutely incredible. And wow. I was just so young and little and insignificant, but I knew I wanted to be.
Yeah, you felt that that was your world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would kind of be like if I was in New York in the 70s and I went to Studio 54 right. and I saw Bianca Jagger and Andy Warhol yeah. and whoever, I'd be like, that's where I want to be. But Camden Palace was yeah. achievable.
Yeah.
Was my era, that was achievable.
When you develop your signatures, I wouldn't say, you know, I know that as a makeup artist, you can do lots of different things. I know sure. that that's part of the job. But I do feel like there tends to be a look that accompanies a makeup artist, you know, yeah. and they do certain things well.
Yeah.
How would you define yours?
I do very beautiful, glamorous, natural looking makeup.
Yeah.
So what I concentrate on is skin texture and subtle definition to make the face look as beautiful as it can without looking that you can see where it starts and finishes.
That's exactly what I was going to say, but also that's something that you've bottled in your makeup, in some cases quite literally, because it feels like your mission, as it were, mm. is to give makeup to people that, and I know this is bandied around a lot, the word empowering is bandied around a lot, but there is something empowering about finding a product that makes you look like you, but better, another really yeah, hackneyed phrase.
Of course.
But that is what you do.
Yeah.
And I think that when I see your work, I think, aha, you know, because it's the eye that pops without knowing quite why it's popping.
Yes.
You know, it's like
yeah.
the eyeliner is there, but yeah. it's not quite, it's not pronounced. You know, so that's something that I think is a really interesting skill mm. because the strength and the courage to pair it back.
Yeah.
It sometimes takes more to do that.
And I think my own journey, if
yes,
you like,
sorry,
from
yeah.
being a makeup artist from the late 80s into mm. the 90s, where in the UK especially it was quite, you could do pretty wild makeup.
Mm.
Suddenly when we hit sort of the early 90s, everything went beige, flat and brown.
Yeah.
And my portfolio was completely not what it was about. And I had to yeah. completely turn around what I was doing. I was lucky enough that I was modelling at the time for a guy called Koto Bolofo, who was a mm. really big Vogue photographer, and mm. he put me in one of the Marco Polo campaigns as a model.
Wow.
And L'Officiel Anna was in L'Uomo Vogue.
Do you have pictures
of that? Yeah. There are,
need to see those.
Check out my Instagram.
All right, I'm on it.
There'll be the odd picture. Okay. Anyway, yeah. it was a very short period in my life. I went to show him my portfolio and my book just wasn't right. Because
mm.
what Koto's makeup style that he loved was red lipstick and that was it.
Okay.
So it was a little bit 1930s, 40s in its
right.
simplicity. The models always looked very fresh, very natural, but they had this Hollywood glamour lipstick.
Right.
And so I was fortunate enough to be booked on a few of his jobs with wonderful magazines, and I could see the other makeup artists, what they were doing mm-hmm. makeup-wise on his models.
Right.
It was a revelation.
Okay.
I had to relearn and retrain myself to a new approach for how to do that sort of style,
yeah.
plus use beiges and browns so they didn't look flat and boring.
When you say retrained yourself, there's something... So you did train initially.
Yeah.
But when you're learning new techniques and things, are you quite good at seeing other people do things and just going, oh, I know how I would do that, and
yeah.
picking it up? So
I think, but that only comes after years of experience.
Right.
You can suddenly break something down. You see someone's makeup. You know how you would achieve that. Mm-hmm. You know the products, whether you'd use fingers, brushes, sponge, whatever. You know what kind of pigments and powders you'd use.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like if you eat well.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you can go to a restaurant because you've been brought up with your parents in the catering industry
mm-hmm.
with a very successful restaurant. You can go to a restaurant. You can eat something, whether it's probably Moroccan or Indian or whatever.
Mm.
You can analyze those flavors, those textures, those tastes, and you will know how to do that.
Yeah.
You won't need a cookbook because you can taste ginger. You can taste the garlic. Yeah, there's a little bit of cumin in there. Yeah, I can do that, and I can simmer those chickpeas for an hour, and it will turn out. It's the same with makeup. You can literally look at something, you analyze it within an instant, and you know how you'll do it.
Which side of the argument do you sit on when people are thinking about either training or not training? Do you think practice is as good as training, or do you think the training is essential?
Everyone's different. I always think you should be open-minded to training and absorb as many different styles you can from a lot of different people. When mm. I started, there were very few people out there to watch and learn from. I think I would have been a very different makeup artist had I had that available to me.
Mm.
But I think these days, if you just do variations of the same makeup. Mm-hmm. You may have a very successful Instagram account where your makeup style is the same, but you just tweak the colors and textures, but the look is always really the same.
Yeah.
But that could be quite limiting. Mm-hmm. For me, what I would like from a makeup artist is someone who can do loads of different sorts of makeup, mm-hmm. loads of different sorts of styles. But within that, people can always identify that you have a signature look.
A bit like a singer, when you know their voice, but they sing different styles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think someone like, you know, Lisa Eldridge does that. I think most of the really successful ones, you can tell. Like, I always was able to tell Mary Greenwell's makeup.
Yeah.
Always. And there's some amazing makeup artists who I look at. And Caroline Barnes, another one who I really... She's more of a contemporary because we're similar ages. And Caroline was so sweet to me in the 2000 and something. Mm. She was working a lot with Kylie. She had been working with Atomic Kitten. Mm-hmm. She couldn't do Atomic Kitten anymore because she was so busy going on tour with Kylie. Mm-hmm. And she suggested that I work with Atomic Kitten because my style... with the skin and the colours and the textures.
I was going to say, your styles aren't wholly dissimilar.
Exactly. Yeah. And I learned a lot from Caroline, and because she told me this is what the girls like, this is what the Atomic Kitten girls don't like, just have tons of bronzer. and I learned loads of things with Caroline.
Tell me about the products that you were using then, when you made that switch from big 80s makeup to pared back, browns and life makeup.
Yeah.
Was there anything you found in the shops that was great?
Well, certainly bases and powders, I was a huge advocate of Clinique Super Balanced Makeup because it was a wonderful, creamy textured foundation that made skin look flawless. The Clinique powders came in quite a few variety of shades. They did the job. They weren't too expensive. Mm-hmm. They looked nice in my kit. I think color-wise, I absolutely love Shu Uemura.
Yeah.
Mary Quant has a few wonderful colours as well. Mm-hmm. Estee Lauder, I was a huge fan of their More Than Mascara.
Mm-hmm. And was there anyone around that time when you were sort of doing lots and lots of different people where you wanted to make them up? You were excited, you know, because you admired them as an artist, and then you did.
I remember when I did Kate Moss and Naomi Campbell for the first time, Tommy Hilfiger was launching his first Sloane Street store. It was during Fashion Week, and it was a big party. Mm-hmm. To do them was quite amazing.
I can imagine.
They were quite controlling, though. Naomi wanted to do quite a lot of the makeup herself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she wanted to apply her base and all this kind of thing. But what was interesting was watching her do her makeup, because, of course, she'd had Kevin O'Quinn do her makeup and she'd had Paul Goebbels do her makeup and Mary Greenwell, obviously, and all the huge mega makeup stars at the time. And then there was little old me there. So she obviously wanted to control how she looked. She didn't know me. We hadn't been introduced.
Yeah.
Hadn't worked with her editorially. So suddenly to work with me, she was obviously a bit nervous. So she put her prescriptive foundation and powder on. And the powder that she used on her face was white. And I was thinking, my God, how's that going to work? But of course, I now developed a white pressed powder myself and know how invisible white powders can actually be without making a black skin look chalky, green or grey or ash or whatever and ghastly.
I love that pressed powder of yours.
Thank you. Thank you.
Use that a lot.
So, but similarly with Kate Moss was different because she let me do whatever I wanted. And the Tommy Hilfiger look was very natural and fresh and very sporty.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're then out looking for products, trying to find the thing you want. At what point do you think, I'm going to have to make some myself?
It wasn't my idea. I did not have that eureka moment. As a makeup artist, if you can't find what you want, you blend and mix on the back of your hand and you pick out from your kit your essentials and you make it work. But it was, I was the makeup spokesperson for Bourjois Cosmetics for 7 years. Mm-hmm. Leslie Chivers, from who was doing PR from Bourjois, mm-hmm. came up to me and said, please be our spokesperson. Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you very much. Lovely. And then after a few years of that, she said to me, why don't you bring out your own makeup? Mm-hmm. And I said, but why would I do that? There's everything out there. MAC was getting bigger and bigger. Mm. Bobbi Brown was out and about. Laura Mercier, Trish Mackey. Boy, there were makeup artist brands out there. Or you could shop at a cheaper drugstore, you know, price tag if you wanted. And then I started thinking about the textures and the colours that I used to create on cheeks for my models or whoever. Mm. If I was on a trip to Miami or the model had to be submerged in water or in a shower or in a swimming pool. And blushes and things, there were cream blushes and there were stains, but you couldn't blend them properly and they wouldn't last long and there weren't a lot of colours.
Yeah.
So I was naturally mixing up things together from my kit. Which I then went to Kryolan in Germany, mm-hmm. and I said, I mix all these different products together to get a look and a finish and a colour and a texture that's long-lasting. Can you take all these elements, put it together and create one product for me? Mm. So after about 6 or 7 months of me going backwards and forwards and trialling, we all came up with the fantastic solution, which was the watercolour liquid cheek colour, which has been, I mean, monumental for me.
Was it instantly successful?
No, because people couldn't get it. They couldn't understand. Not that they couldn't get it, that they couldn't buy it.
Yeah.
They didn't get it. They didn't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a liquid. It ran everywhere.
For anyone who doesn't know what it is, how would you describe what it is and how to put it on?
It's a concentrated liquid pigment in a tiny little bottle where you literally just need one dot of colour on each cheek, blend it. You've got the most beautiful flush and bloom on your cheek in a different array of colours. And whether you want an illuminator, a matte shade, something with a little bit of shimmer, there's something for everyone.
And you put it on basically either your foundation or your naked skin.
Yes.
And you can put it on with fingers or with a brush.
Absolutely.
And yet some of the, like the, I'm thinking of the peachy pinky colours for me.
Yeah.
They just make it look like you're alive. It's one of those things where the makeup fuses with your skin and you can't see the edge. It's not there. You know, when people talk about no makeup makeup, I always think of actually it's the ideal. You can build it up. But if you want to look like you are just naturally like blushing, it does that.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'd imagine the minute you found the right formula, you were like, this is it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, bringing out a brand is really difficult, but you've got, because there is a hell of a lot of competition out there.
Yeah.
In all sorts of categories, skin, mascara, eyes, whatever.
Yeah.
But I've stuck with the watercolor because for me, blusher was always something that I really loved doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes, well, quite often actually, when I put a foundation and concealer on someone, instead of then doing powder and then doing eyes and then lips and doing cheeks last or cheeks before lips, I do cheeks first after I've applied the base.
Okay.
Because suddenly whoever was sitting in the chair who I was making up and looking at their reflection, they would sit differently.
Do you know what? It's funny you say that.
Really?
Because when I do my own makeup, if I'm having a particularly ugly day, you know when you look in the mirror and you're like, oh no. The first thing I do is basically redo my skin. So I, you know, cover it up, whatever's going on, and then put the blush on and stuff. And then it's almost like I'm almost not wearing makeup, but have reset my face. So I can imagine that psychologically, when you're a model or you're an actress and you're looking at yourself in the mirror, it must be awful when you look pale and tired and crap. So that's very astute of you.
It was a trick I just did once when I was working at the Dorchester on some actress on a press junket. She'd really had just flown in and she looked like death. And because they work so hard, these girls.
Yeah.
And I just thought, let's put some colour in her cheeks.
Yeah.
Let's do that. And then she suddenly looked bright and the eyes looked brighter. And funnily enough, it really helped me to create the right balance of how much eyes and lips to put on.
Yeah.
Because when you work on one zone of a face, then you've really got to balance the rest of the colour on, whether it's the cheeks or the lips. It's all got to work together. And I think because at college I was taught to do the foundation, the concealer, the powder, the eyes, the cheeks, in that order.
Yeah.
Suddenly, when I changed that order, I created I could make the face look better, almost.
But also, it's very in keeping with what you do, because once you've done that, you know how far you need to go to make someone look good and to make their face pop.
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, if ever I want to do a red lip on someone, I won't do the eyes and the cheeks first, actually. I'll do the red lip first.
Yeah.
Because then if I want that to stand out, because what can happen is if you do a big, dark, smoky eye because you think, yeah, that's going to look great with the red, once you've done both zones quite strong, it can look too much. What I also like to do is not spend too much time on the bit that somebody doesn't like on their face. I like to emphasize their good bits. So if they think, oh, I've got really small eyes, or, you know, I wish I had higher cheekbones and all this kind of thing, I don't actually spend too much time on that. I'll make their skin look great, and then I'll show them really quickly, that's all you need to do with your cheekbones.
But that's also such a big part of your job must be dealing with the psychology of whoever's sitting in front of you. And the way someone looks has such a huge impact. I mean, when you ever confronted with someone who is feeling rubbish about themselves, maybe someone who's been ill or is struggling, do you have, other than making them look as good as you can as quickly as possible and avoiding their bad bits, do you find that your bedside manner, as it were, has a massive impact too?
Yes, of course. And you work so closely with someone. Hairdresser, of course, works behind.
Yes.
You know, hands are on the head. You're working very closely, sometimes very early in the morning, before any of us have really had breakfast.
Yeah.
You're working very intimately and closely in someone's space, in the you know. So you have to tread carefully. But I think makeup artists generally just are gifted that they can connect with people on a certain level that makes you bond with someone instantaneously. And I think that makeup artists have this character that helps that process begin your relationship with someone.
Well, good makeup artists. I mean, so I've, in my journalist job, I've had my makeup done by a lot of good and a lot of not as good makeup artists. And I wouldn't say it's actually the end result, although the end result obviously does matter. But the thing I've noticed about the very, very good makeup artists is that they know how to talk to you in a way that makes you feel like they're going to make you look great. Even when you're not looking in the mirror, they're going to you, oh, how lovely, I'll make this bigger. And you're sort of thinking, oh, I'm going to look great. This is brilliant. When when someone who isn't as good at makeup is doing your makeup, they make you feel like your face is a problem. You know? And I think that that's something that is being very obvious to me. And it tends to be that the very famous, well-known, brilliant makeup artists know that it's not only about making you look good, it's about making you feel good. From the off.
I think experience as well tells you, you can instinctively know what someone won't like so much about their face.
Yeah.
You can just tell that. It's almost like a hairdresser. Again, I always like the analogy sometimes because it's easier for people to understand. That if someone sits in the barber's chair who's got quite thin hair, of course the hairdresser knows, I'll make that thicker.
Yeah.
Make it wavy. I'll give her those beachy, tousley, sexy look that she probably wants to achieve, but she can't. I'll show her how to do it. It's the same with makeup. You kind of instinctively know, when you look at someone's face, what they will want to hear.
Yeah.
And how they will want to look. And they will want you want to make them look the best they ever have done. And again, it's not looking the best so that people can say you're beautiful, aren't you great for 40? It's about you're looking as good as you can on that day.
That expression, 440, 450, 460, or whatever, drives me mad. Because I feel like it's absolutely right that someone wants to just look good.
Yes.
Full stop, you know, feel good, look good, whatever, you know, both effects of it. But the thing when someone's sort of quantifying that is, oh, don't you look good for someone who has, or for someone who is, or it's so sad.
I know, they just got to wait till they are 40 or 50 or something.
Yeah.
But I love the whole rebellion now of women in 40s, 50s and 60s, you know, making youngsters sit up and think, you know, we're not past it and we can still look as good and we're still as sprightly as ever.
For anyone who is, I can say of a certain age, but not 20 listening, do you approach makeup differently, or are there tips for if someone is older and they want to be, you know, engaging in makeup as much as anyone who's 20, but they also have that fear of looking like they've put on too much makeup or whatever?
Yeah, I can't generalise. I think every woman, regardless of whether she's 20 or 40 or 60, you have to tailor make the makeup to suit her and to, because every woman's skin is different. A woman who hasn't smoked will have different skin to someone who has smoked. They can be the same age, but the skin texture will be different. Pigmentation will be different. Similarly, someone who's been in the sun a lot, you know, there'll be challenges there as well. So you can't really, really generalize. Certainly, as someone gets older, regardless of whether they've smoked or been in the sun a lot, they will have slightly drier skin.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are some women, when they reach the 40s and 50s, they go through the menopause or even suffer adult acne.
Yeah.
So there are changes that happen biologically, hormonally, that can just come out of nowhere.
So it's as personal as any makeup, basically, doesn't
yes,
it? Yeah, the age
absolutely.
Is just another
there's,
element.
For me, there's no tick box. Like, you're 40, you've got to wear a Laura Mercier camouflage concealer, you've got to wear a Bobbi Brown lipstick, you've got to wear a Daniel Sandler blusher, blah, blah, blah. Every woman is different. And that's one of the things that I think Instagram and some of the social accounts don't always kind of admonish, and they we're not seeing enough different sort of makeup styles that are relevant to many different age groups.
Yeah.
And what I fear is that some of the very successful big stars like Kim Kardashian, if she, I think she'll probably get stuck in a time warp and she won't adjust her makeup as she gets older. You know, the funny thing is, when I have met ladies in their 60s who were told in the 80s that they should always wear blue eyeliner, you know the type, you know, blonde hair, highlights, pearls and wellies, still wearing the blue eyeliner.
Amazing.
We love them. and I say, you know, you don't really have to wear blue eyeliner and navy blue mascara anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you can wear black. Oh, no, black's too harsh. You know, I should wear brown mascara. It's personal choice.
Yeah.
You know, I can make recommendations. This is what I think will make you look fantastic. But people sometimes see themselves the same way. And when they say to me, Dan, you're looking in my makeup bag, what can I chuck away? Mm-hmm. What should I keep? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, you've got 7 different shades of MAC Spice pencil by different brands, which is great. And that's your safety net.
Yeah.
And they're very wearable and very commercial and very easy to wear colours. But why not wear something with a little bit more peach or a little bit more pink, just to update it and just freshen how you look?
Yeah.
You know, because often women can change their haircut, their hair colour, but they don't always feel that the makeup should change.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. I hadn't thought of that before. People are very willing to embrace new hair, but
yes.
not new
or
makeup.
Or nails. Nails can be black, blue, glitter, whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I can't wear red lipstick. That's far too bright. Really?
Yeah. Now, tell me about you then and your life. What you do, because, you know, you are a busy, busy, busy man. Brand, working makeup artist. You know, you do lots of different things. And you have to be, I wouldn't say functioning optimum. That's your choice. But you look in rude health to me. So what is it that you do?
Sweet.
Do you have ways of living and things you do that sort of make you feel good and help you out?
I don't, that's very sweet of you, I must say. I really don't know, that there's really no secret. I just live day to day. My work life is very varied. I've got a fantastic private life. Live in the country now, which is amazing.
So you moved from London to the country, right?
To Norfolk.
Yeah.
And very little stress. I come into London.
You have
when
dogs
I have
as
to,
well.
Yes, 2 beautiful babies.
Yeah.
Sid and Elsie and a fantastic husband, Simon. But I've never been anyone who does anything to too much of an extreme. I'm a rather safe person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really drink a lot. I don't smoke. I don't really go out an awful lot anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I go to bed quite early.
Time's quite early?
Oh, 9 o'clock.
That is early.
But I'm a really bad sleeper, and I always have been.
Okay.
So I go to bed hoping that tonight I will have a fantastic night's sleep.
Oh, no.
But I always wake up in the night,
and
then we're up about 6 o'clock because the dogs want to go for a wee or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then we might as well have a cup of tea and watch a bit of telly.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of very ordinary part of my life. But what I love really is working on the brand now. That's my focus.
Yeah.
And I'm able to do that. I've got a fantastic sister who runs the company with me.
Mm-hmm.
My sister, that's my sister Nikki. My niece Emma works with us as well now, head of marketing.
Okay.
So we're a very small family unit. You know, we're not owned by L'Oreal or Lauder.
Mm-hmm.
It's me and my sister who do everything.
So great.
And I think I'm just very lucky. Before you started, you put the record button. I said to you that I've never really planned anything with my career.
Mm.
And I really haven't. I very much believe in living day to day and just doing good stuff.
Mm.
And what will be, will be. And I don't have a goal. I don't have a goal that Lauder will one day give me X millions in a check. That's not the reason why I do my brand or why I work.
Mm.
I really love what I do.
Have you ever felt because it is a bitchy industry. I hate that. I mean, not always. There are very lovely people. But, you know, it's famously an industry in which people are a bit cutthroat. And you do have to, it's a talent industry. So you have to some extent, be a bit bolshy and pushy. But then on the other hand, if that's not in your nature and, you know, you're a kind, humble person, and even the way you've spoken about yourself, like, you know, massively underplayed what you've done, and you're, you know, you've had an incredible career and you have an incredible career. But have you ever felt the conflict of that, where you've thought, I should probably be the person who's at the door going, let me in, I'm amazing, but also you're a bit more tiring?
Yeah, no, I just can't do it. I have to follow my instincts.
Yeah.
When you work in a part of a team in a photo shoot, it's not about you. It's generally about the model, it's or the whoever you're making up, and it's about the photographer, and then it's about the client, really. Hair and makeup are the last people who are very important. You're all doing your bit, but there are people who are more important, that, you know, and especially the talent needs to be spoiled quite a lot to get the best out of them. But I've always been a person who, as I say, I never had a plan. The bitchiness, I probably never even realised it was really going on. I just thought, well, they're just catty comments. And the great thing about being freelance is you may never see that person again. You probably will. But then you're only suffering them in a studio for a few hours. And there are some characters who are just, especially hairdressers for some reason, who are so over the top. And they're really loud, and they make everyone laugh, and that's fantastic. But it kind of, it just sort of made me feel a bit cringy sometimes, that I didn't want to be that over-the-top clown. I just want to do my job, have a nice day, get on with people, and hope that they book me the next time. And I kind of like to be in the background. And I think that that's why as well, I'm quite a private person with Instagram and Twitter and things. Like, you'll see some private things, but I never really reveal too much about what goes on behind the scenes with my work and the other sort of makeup work that I do. I'm quite private like that. So really, I've always felt with my career that I just let things happen as they naturally were going to happen. And if there was any sort of bitchiness that was going on, it kind of went over my head. And I didn't absorb that negative energy.
But that's a really good way also to keep your head down and get on with your job, I think, is the way to preserve yourself, because otherwise you get really caught up in that, you forget the work, you start to become a real victim of it. And I think that if it's something that you struggle with, either go freelance or take yourself out of it, because it's just not good for anyone. And particularly as a makeup artist, because you are there doing a job for someone else.
And I think anyone coming, who's young, coming into this industry, there will be the knocks, there will be some nasty comments and things you don't like hearing, and you will take them very personally. But you know what, guys? Let it wash over you. Be bigger than that, and just keep your head focused, head down, do the best you can, and you will have a long and fantastic career.
Yeah, it's advice for pretty much every career, I think, in a way.
Absolutely, it's common sense.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.